Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 5th of February. In the year 2005, the state of Utah started a unique and what's turned out to be very effective program to end chronic homelessness. A pilot program was started taking 17 people in Salt Lake City who had spent an average of 25 years on the streets and put them in apartments. Caseworkers were assigned to help them become self-sufficient. The Housing First program was to end chronic homelessness in Utah within 10 years, and through 2012, chronic homelessness has been reduced 74%. Utah's model has been duplicated in other states and communities in America. Joining us from the studios of KCPW in Salt Lake City, Gordon Walker, who is director of Utah's Division of Housing and Community Development. He served as deputy undersecretary for the Department of Housing and Urban Development during the Reagan administration. He's also national president of the Council of State Community Development Agencies, and they represent all 50 states on policy matters with the federal government. Gordon, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. We're happy to be with you.
Yeah, anxious to hear this hour myself. Lloyd Pendleton is also with us, an advocate for the homeless for a decade. In 2004, as a loaned executive, he wrote and implemented Utah's 10-year plan for ending chronic homelessness. He became director of the Homeless Task Force and has worked on ending homelessness and reducing overall homelessness by 2015. He was an executive with the Ford Motor Company for 14 years and worked for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in the Welfare Department for a number of years. Lloyd, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Tell me about the roads with you first, Gordon, that got you involved in this kind of work. Why was chronic homelessness something that you decided to devote so much time to?
Actually, when I became involved with the state of Utah, I wanted to make sure that we did something that was effective. And as we looked at the various issues that happen within social service programs, this was a program that appeared to be have the possibility of making some inroads. And as we did the research and looked at other research around the country to see what was being done with homelessness, we identified the chronic homelessness as a group of individuals that we might be able to have some success with. And so in looking at it, we decided to adopt a Housing First model. It used to be that homeless individuals would have to change their lives before they were acceptable in housing. And what we did is we said, let's house the homeless. I know that's a novel idea, but let's house the homeless, and then we'll be able to end it. What we found was that we needed to add some supportive services to make it effective, and then we've learned as we've gone along.
Mm-hmm. And the idea of having a home instead of a shelter, which I guess is still the standard model in most cities and communities throughout the country, seems to be a very large thing, doesn't it, Lloyd, to have a home?
Yes, it does. And it's a program we picked up that started in New York with the Housing First model, and we brought Dr. Samson Barris out here to make us aware of this whole approach, and we implemented it very quickly because we saw that it would work, but we wanted to test it with those 17, and we found that it did work. So it's a very unique approach, and we're pleased with what we've been able to accomplish.
Tell me about the homeless population, starting with chronic homeless in the state of Utah. Are there a lot of homeless people?
We have. We've been testing this, and with Lloyd and me, both of us are really strong, interested in numbers, and so we worked to make sure that we could rely on the numbers before we made a lot of hoopla about this. But when we started, homeless population in Utah was about 0.6% of the total population. And of that, we identified just short of 14,000 individuals that were homeless and about 1,932 that were chronically homeless. So we identified very clearly what we were dealing with and where we were working with. And from there, once we knew what our numbers were, then we developed a program to, over the 10-year period, to specifically work with the chronic homeless population.
And by chronically homeless, you mean what?
a chronically homeless individual, and these are definitions that are established by the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
The chronically homeless population are single individuals that have been homeless for a year or longer, or who have had four episodes of homelessness in a three-year period, and who have a debilitating condition, which would be mental illness, alcoholism, drugs, or some other disability that would make it very difficult for them to function on their own.
And how did you decide where these people were going to live? Did you build structures, or were there apartments available?
We did everything. We have built structures. You know, when you start a program that really people have tried to do for a lot of years, you say, well, let's pull out all the stops. So we built buildings. Our very first building was 100 single-family, 100 single-unit apartments in a building. And it was not everybody had faith in it. Not everybody believed that this would work. And that's why the pilot program that we'd done with the 17 individuals was very important. But as we built this, we then took, selected, and when I say we, this program is a function of having collaboration at all levels of government and with the private sector, with the service sector, the nonprofit, faith-based group, everybody that had an interest in this. So when I'm using the word we, I'm talking about everybody. And that's one thing that has been very success model is a collaboration. We selected 100 of the most difficult cases and put them in these 100 one-bedroom apartments and provided case management services, provided help, whatever we could do to make them successful in the home, in establishing a home for them.
Mm-hmm. Tell me how you were able to gather all that support. I think homelessness is something that we're aware of when we have a string of days in Wisconsin that are minus 18 or minus 4, and you think about people who are out on the street. Other than that, it's not something that we pay a whole lot of attention to, much less decide that we need to do something as a community, all of us, to make sure that these people have a roof over their heads and have some kind of life. So how did you gather this support for so many people to say this is an important issue for us to act on?
I don't think that we're any different here in Utah. We worry about it when the snows come, when it's really cold, but we all have our own lives. But what we determined, and this how we did it, and I've got to credit Lloyd Pendleton with doing this, one of the things that you have to have is a champion. And we identified a champion. Lloyd was working with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and we got together, and I suggested that he come as a loaned executive. It was arranged, and he became the driver in developing the 10-year plan, and then began one by one building relationships with every one of these organizations. And it is nothing more than just good, hard work and getting everybody who has a stated interest in the issue to join in and have the vision of what it was we were going to do.
And to add to that, the governor at the time, Governor Olin Walker, was very supportive of this program. And so her lieutenant governor then chaired the state homeless coordinating committee, and the successive governors and lieutenant governors have been very involved. So the support has been all the way from the top down through the governor's office to county commissioners to mayors. And so it's political involvement has been very important from that support as well as the service providers.
Mm-hmm. From what I've read, Lloyd, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that you had a change of heart about all of this. I read that you, as many people believe, think, well, get a job, you know, pull yourself up by the bootstraps. It's still important American strain of thought. And so you had a change of heart. You had a change of thought when you became involved in this issue.
I did. I grew up on a ranch, and so you learn to work hard, and I would see people that were homeless, and I would say, you know, we call them hobos in those days. I would say, why don't they get a job? They're, you know, they're pulling themselves up by the bootstraps. And so as I became more aware of their circumstances and realized that most of them had been abused in childhood and didn't have boots to pull themselves up by the bootstraps. And so I became much, have a much different attitude, realizing there's still accountability that needs to be there, but at the same time, we need to reach out as a community and give them opportunities, real good choices to come into housing and to get into the self-reliance capability.
And to say nothing of the humanitarian aspect of this, but there's also a financial aspect in reading information about what you're doing. 10% of the homeless population chronically homeless, but they use 50 to 60% of homeless services, and that winds up to be quite a bit of money per person, doesn't it?
It is, and it's some research done by Dennis Culhane out of Philadelphia made those determinations of the 10% and the 50%. And when we heard that, we thought, well, that may be true in New York, but not in Utah. So we came back from our initial exposure to these ideas and did some research in our own homeless shelter and looked at those that stayed longer than 6 months. And we found over a five-year period that 10% of those to 13% of those used 60-some percent of the bed nights. And so it was true here. So that became a focal point to realize that as we target that group of individuals who are high consumers, chronic consumers, are expensive, then we can get a return on the investment and make that case more effectively with the people who make the decisions on funding.
I know that you've brought the numbers down significantly. Can you tell us what they are, how effective you've been already in ending chronic homelessness, or at least bringing the number of people who are in that category way down?
When we did our point-in-time count last January, and we do the point-in-time count on the fourth Wednesday of January each year, so the results that we have are as of last January. We've reduced the chronic homeless population by 74% from where we started. Now, we've done the point-in-time count just last week. We don't have the final numbers on that. We have a reasonable confidence that it will be reduced even further this year, and we hope to finish that up within the next year or so.
And to add to that, we built new facilities, housing, we remodeled facilities, and we've also done what is called scattered sites. So we have single site facilities that have 100 or 84 units, and then we have a scattered site. So using those models, we've generated over 900 housing units for the chronically homeless individuals. And so having the housing units and reaching out through outreach or into the shelters, identifying them, and then inviting them to come into housing. And so with that effort with housing and case management, we've been able to bring them off the street, have them come off the street. And so that's been the reason for the success.
How do you pay for it, Lloyd?
Well, it's a combination. The federal government, this is also a goal of the federal government. They have set up with the Opening Doors plan that they created a few years ago to target to end chronic homelessness, and they've added in veterans homelessness by the end of 2015. So the continuum of care, or the HUD money, has been focused on providing these kinds of resources. The state of Utah has put money into it. Private foundations have put money into it, as well as county governments. And so it's been a collaboration of many sources of funding. But probably as important is the retargeting and repurposing or using existing money, focusing on the chronic homeless. So it's been a combination of many things to pay for it.
We haven't had any extra money. It's not like we've had any extra money that any other political jurisdiction would already have access to. And I think that that's a very important point. When we started, people would say, oh, we need more money to solve this problem. And that really wasn't the issue. The issue was how do we make use with the resources that we have and allocate them properly in order to effectively do what it was that we wanted to do.
You mentioned veterans. I believe it was you, Lloyd, who said this, and we've heard statistics that there are an appallingly high number of veterans who make up our homeless population. Is that true in Utah as well?
It's about 14%, and that stayed fairly consistent.
Why is that?
That the homeless veterans?
Mm-hmm.
There's many of reasons. Many of them come back with PTSD and other issues that they have to deal with, and so And I think that's a pretty consistent percentage across the countries in that 10 to 15, 20% range.
What has been interested with the veterans' homelessness, however, after our survey this past year, our point in time count, we realized as we identified the homeless veterans throughout the state that while they were not all housed, that we had sufficient resources in the pipeline to house them. And so it was interesting that the our local veterans representatives used the term that we had effectively ended chronic homelessness among veterans because we had resources. We had just completed an additional facility that had some excess capacity, and so they're just in the process of finishing that up. We're very grateful that we've been able to have the resources to help our veterans because they've done so much for us, and now it's great to be able to give them a place, get them taken care of, at least with the chronic population.
And one of the things I think that we want to clarify is that when we use the term ending homelessness or chronic homelessness is used, we know that there are individuals who will choose to stay on the street because of many issues. And so for us, we've made the commitment we'll give them a housing opportunity, and we'll continue to do so. That's our commitment because there's people who will continue to fall into homelessness or make those choices. But as a community, we can reach out and say, yes, you have a housing opportunity. So that for us is when we've done what we can do as a community and quote-unquote ending chronic homelessness.
We're going to welcome phone calls for both our guests. Our guests are joining us from Salt Lake City today. The state of Utah has really done phenomenal work in ending chronic homelessness and have the goal of reducing overall homelessness significantly by the year 2015. The program is not unique to Salt Lake City, but it's a model in other communities and other states have been examining what's going on in Utah and thinking about doing the same where they happen to be. Our two guests are Gordon Walker, who's director of Utah's Division of Housing and Community Development, and Lloyd Pendleton, who as a loaned executive in 2004, he was working for, he worked for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and with Ford Motor Company for a number of years. Lloyd wrote Utah's 10-year plan for ending chronic homelessness. It begins, of course, with homes for people who are chronically homeless, and we have yet to talk about the case management services which they offer to all of the people who get a home. So we'll talk about how extensive that is. Welcoming your thoughts on this program, what do you think of a state taking this kind of action on this issue? Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joining us from Salt Lake City today, studios of KCPW, Gordon Walker and Lloyd Pendleton, and we're talking about Utah's program, a significant one, fairly long-lasting to and extremely effective to end chronic homelessness and ultimately to reduce the overall homeless population quite significantly by 2015. Let's go to phone calls. 800-486-8655 is the number, and Ray in Rhinelander is our first caller. Hi, Ray.
Hi. This is very good. I want to compliment these people on approaching this. It's amazing how when you take the monetary part of it and looking at solving the problem and looking at the human service and social service part and combining that, I think they came up with a very unique way of handling this. It helps all parties involved. My question is, now that you're setting a precedent for this, which I think is great and I think other areas should do this, how do you think this will affect the larger metro areas? You mentioned New York, but like Los Angeles, Chicago, Denver, wherever, and you think this model would work, or what do you think?
We've been very careful not to try and say anything that what we're doing would work anyplace else. But we have identified some basic principles that I think that are transferable. Once we made the decision to go ahead, identified a champion, worked to create the collaboration between everybody that's involved, and also dealt with the compassion issue, we think that certainly many of these areas that you're describing can use these same principles. Maybe it would be a little bit different. Maybe it would be the same. But we do know that it's that we can help. There are cities that are doing a very good job now that can do it. Certainly the cities that you've mentioned, like Los Angeles and New York, have major, major problems. But I know that they're all trying to do something.
We haven't talked very much, Lloyd, about the case management aspect of this. Once a home is found for someone who is chronically homeless, what is the case management situation?
Well, it becomes very important that case managers are there, because taking an individual who's been on the streets for 20 years, putting them into a housing unit and leaving them alone just won't work. Mm-hmm. They have to adjust. It's a change in their lifestyle. So the case manager is there. So we realize that all of these 900-plus units we put together need to have case management, and so that's usually a bigger challenge to getting the funds for the case management. But the case manager helps them deal with just day-to-day living, as well as they stabilize, helping them get treatment programs for substance abuse, some mental health issues. And so that is as crucial, as important as the housing piece. So they have to go get it to go together in order to be successful.
And are you looking at a population that will eventually be able to work?
That's what we found is they got stabilized and were in housing for a while. Then many of them said, we want to do something. A big concern was most of them are on disability insurance, and they're afraid that if they went to work, they would lose their disability. But we know that they can do work and have a certain amount of income and not lose their disability insurance. And so we've had people come from our Department of Workforce Services and sit down with them individually and determine how much they could work and get income and not lose their disability insurance. And so we started a pilot program in one of our larger facilities about 3 years ago, and we took from about 12% who were getting income through employment up to 35% in 24 months getting income through employment. Then we rolled that out to our other facilities. And so we're looking at housing, stabilization, increased income through employment is also a very important part, because employment is key to helping people feel good about themselves and making a contribution.
Right.
And it may only be 10 hours a month at minimum wage, but at least they're getting income through employment and doing something and contributing to the community.
Yeah, it's very important in life, isn't it? Having a home,
very much.
A job, right?
Yeah.
Thanks, Ray. Thanks so much for your call. Let's go to Julie next. Hi, Julie.
Hi there. I think that the conversation has begun to drift a little bit toward what I'm questioning. I would first like to say that this is a very empathetic and intelligent straight-line look at what defining the problem and funding a good response to it. And the question I have is whether the people who are homeless are placed, quote, in housing on their own, or if there is an attempt to place them with, let's say, a couple who's 55, their children have left and begun their own lives, placing these people with a mentor of sorts. In our own situation, we have a dairy farm. We have animals and a very productive way of living, so and working. And it would seem to me this could be therapeutic as well for homeless people. So I'm wondering if that's been blended into their program.
That hasn't been as of yet. One of the challenges we faced with this, these individuals have a disabling condition, and quite often a high percentage of them have mental health issues, 40-50%, substance abuse issues. Some of them have both of those. And so it would be a real challenge to move them into a retired couple's situation. We encourage volunteers, which they do, come and to the facilities and work with the individuals. And so we've worked from that standpoint. I mean, I like the idea, and but right now I think that's going to be a big challenge to make that blend until we get a little more stabilization among this group.
Might that work better, not for the chronically homeless population, but for another homeless population?
Right. Yes. Those basically 80% of the people across the country and here in Utah are homeless 30 days or less, 33 days or less. Mm. So it's temporarily homelessness that just to deal with. And about 10% are episodically homeless in and out, and 10% are chronically long-term homeless. And so, yes, those that are homeless temporarily or episodically probably could fit that model a lot better.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Julie, so much for your call. Jeff in Adams, hi.
Hi, good morning, good afternoon. I got a question, a couple questions about the cost. Is most of this being built with private funds, or is there maybe a lot of Section 8 housing involved in this?
Actually, we've used a variety of funds, and as I mentioned before, you have to pull everything together in order to make it work. We have used federal funds, state funds. Some properties have the use of Section 8. We've had donations from the private sector, from private foundations, local financial institutions. Everybody has participated in order to make this work. What we're trying to do and what we found is that if we do this, it's actually a cost savings. Every year when I would present to the legislature, I would present this as a business model, that if we were to house these individuals, that it was actually a cost savings. And we did a lot of research in the, to verify our numbers and to make sure that it was correct. And we found that our cost, if we housed an individual, cost all of the various levels of government and service providers about $12,000 a year. And if we didn't house them and left them on the street, the cost to society was about $20,000. So by doing this, the cost is taken care of through a cost savings mechanism. So it's a cost savings to do this. And then always my last line with the legislature would be to say, and oh, by the way, we're saving lives, because we literally have found that we are literally saving lives and increasing longevity among this population that is without housing.
You had another question, Jeff?
The $12,000 answered my question. That's $12,000 per person. But the $20,000, what are some of the side costs that I have no idea what they are? I'm just asking to be educated here. What are those? You know, okay, what was some of the things figured into the $20,000 cost?
What happens is these individuals on the street get arrested a lot by the police. They go to jail a lot because of minor offenses, you know, loitering, open container, trespassing. So there's a lot of jail time. They also may get inebriated. They call the 911, and they will come, and that's $600-$700 per run. They'll take them to the emergency room. And so it's a combination of all those emergency services. We have individuals that will go to the emergency room several 30 or 20 or 40 times a year. And so those become the cost to the community that we included in that study.
How do you approach the people who are homeless? How do you let them know about this whole program?
Well, there's two major ways. Only about 19% of our homeless population in our count are not sheltered during the winter. And HUD requires that all of the folks, all of the states, do a point-in-time count the last 10 days of January, and we picked the last Wednesday, because most of them will be sheltered at that time. So we engage them in the shelter system. In addition to that, we have outreach teams that go out in vans, they go along the riverbanks, they go up the canyon, and they will walk up to the camps and engage them. And some of those, and once a week, the medical team goes out and they take a look at what some of the issues are and do some on-site treatment if they need to, or bring them into some medical services. So it's a combination of in the shelter and outreach.
Thanks, Jeff, so much for your call. We have some lines open if you'd like to join our conversation. We're talking about Utah's extraordinary program to end chronic homelessness and to significantly reduce overall homelessness. It's a model program, and we're talking with the person who wrote the whole plan for Utah and with the director of Utah's Division of Housing and Community Development. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. You can reach us through the talk at WPR.org. You can also go to our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, to reach this conversation. John in Madison, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me on. This is a great topic. I'm really glad to hear about this program. In Madison, Wisconsin here, a lot of our homeless people are people who are recently released from prison. So you have a lot of high-risk offenders getting out with probation and parole requirements, and they have little support in the community, if any. And I'm just wondering, in Utah, did you encounter a similar situation? And if you did, how did you work with those people, and what sorts of solutions did you come up with? And I'll take the answer off the air. Thanks very
John.
Much.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, John, for that question. We worked with the Department of Corrections as looking part of the discharge planning, and early in this process, they had been the prison system had been discharging individuals to the street. And when we made them aware that this was a challenge, all of those that come out of prison now have to have an address for the 75% that go on to parole. There is a group that terminates. Some of those will show up in the shelter, and we just did a study, and it looks like that's about 2 to 4% give their last address as the incarceration when they show up in the shelter. But it is a challenge. When we did another survey, about 73% of the homeless population have a criminal history, and generally it's just minor offenses. So it is a challenge we're addressing, and we're getting a handle on it, but we still have more to do.
Mm-hmm. 73%. Can you give us the stories behind that? Why would that be the case?
Well, basically, as they did the surveys at the last point in time count, they sat down and said, all right, have you been incarcerated? Have you been in jail? Have you been in prison? And, you know, they weren't at that time, obviously, but over the years, and we're looking at the chronically homeless individuals, these are chronically homeless, they've had a lot of interaction with the criminal justice system.
Mm-hmm. The homeless people who are not chronically homeless, 33 days or less, you say they are homeless. Let's talk a little bit about the services for that population. And you know, most of us could say there, but for the grace of God go I. You could lose a job easily. You could not be able to find another one. You could have a medical emergency, and your finances could be wiped out. I guess all of us are that kind of situation away from being homeless. Can you describe what that population is, why they're able to find homes after 33 days, and how you're working with them?
Well, that group comes in. These are the come into the shelter system. They don't pay anything to come into the emergency shelter system. There are case managers there that work with them, and 50% of those that come into the shelter system will leave without any financial assistance being needed. And what they need is contacts, an opportunity to mm-hmm. have a respite, to kind of gather their family together, themselves together, and connect with the case manager, and then be referred out to apartments or landlords that will work with them. And so 50% of those will leave without any financial needed support. The other 50% will need some support, and that could amount to $3,000, $4,000 for deposits, utility deposits, helping them get into that. So the group basically they just need a little bit of help and a little bit of contact and networking in order to make that leap back into housing.
And what about jobs for that group of people? Are they plentiful? Are they easy to find?
That's a challenge, although there's a relatively good job market here in Utah. 20% or so that are in the shelter system are working. They've just had, like you say, the emergency, a medical issue, or whatever that's caused them to have to go into the shelter system for a while. But they also work with them, get them to housing, and they start working to help get some jobs. And so there's that. More can be done, but that's being worked on.
Welcoming more phone calls in a moment. We're talking about what Utah is doing to end homelessness by 2015, the amazing work they've done with a chronically homeless population, giving them a home free of charge, and then social services working with these people to deal with addiction problems and mental health issues, et cetera. They really have been able to do remarkable work, and other states are paying attention to what is being done in Utah. Gordon Walker, director of Utah's Division of Housing and Community Development, is with us. And Lloyd Pendleton, who's in 2004 is a loaned executive, wrote and implemented Utah's 10-year plan for ending chronic homelessness. He became director of the Homeless Task Force and has been working on this ever since. Phone lines are open if you'd like to join us. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, it's how Utah is very effectively working with the homeless population, chronically homeless, and those who are homeless, the average is 33 days or less to get their lives together and get them services that are needed. We go to Ruth next in Madison. Hi, Ruth.
Hi. I was situationally homeless for 6 months back in 1988 because I was sharing an apartment with somebody who then threatened my life. And I was certainly not going to sign on to renew the lease for that situation. Couldn't stay there after saying I'm not going to renew the lease, and you know, because it wasn't safe for that. And I doubled up somewhere, but it's not the same as having a place to be. But I was working full-time the whole time I was homeless, but I couldn't get another apartment because my last name wasn't Kennedy, and I couldn't afford to buy outright both, you know, buildings, the one that where I was on the lease with the batterer and the new place. And so I just needed a place to be. But I closed the day that my lease ended, I closed on my house. But I couldn't get it before that day because I was on that lease. And the other thing is that I serve on Madison's Housing First committee.
Oh, you do?
And,
oh.
Yes. And we've been doing an awful lot of stuff with the agencies here. I want to say, like, Porch Light, for example, and some of the veterans groups that are doing so much for, you know, trying to arrange for buildings with on-site counseling for the individual's needs. Like, veterans have special needs that nobody else has, you know, and they have, sometimes there's dual diagnosis. And so, like, one of the agencies was thinking about buying two building complex of apartments, and they were going to have the people with alcohol and drug addiction in one building and the people with the dual diagnosis of mental illness and AODA in the other building with on-site counselors and whatnot. I'm not quite sure how that's been going, but I know that was something that was being talked about. And so, you know, really you cannot and people will not deal with things like their addictions until they have a place to be, until you have a place to put your things, until you have a mm-hmm. safe place to go. Mm-hmm. You're not going to worry about that other stuff.
Yeah, very eloquently stated. Thank you so much for your call.
Actually, Ruth's comments, I think, are very valuable. In putting this into perspective, when she was describing how she became situationally homeless, that's truly the face of a certain segment of the homeless population. I know that in Madison that you have some really great people. I've met with them before at the national level, and I know that you're really doing a great job with your homeless population there, and also working very strongly with the Housing First model. So I think that that's great.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Ruth, for your call. And I think she also highlighted in such an eloquent way having a safe place to be and how we all take that for granted. If you don't have that, if you don't have a place you go home to, your life is just sort of at loose ends completely, isn't it?
I think that that's very, very true. Those of us with a lock door between us and the rest of the world may not appreciate the significance of that, for as opposed to someone who doesn't have that. But the fact is, if you're worried about where you're going to sleep tonight, you're really incapable of functioning properly during the day, whether you have a job or not.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a constant worry, and certainly the concept of security. Actually, Kathleen, may I just comment briefly? You used the word about free housing just before the last break. And may I say that the housing that we're offering is not free, that everyone has to pay something. There is an accountability. The individuals have sign a lease with whoever is managing the apartment. They have the capacity to be evicted if they don't take care of the property, or if they're if they exhibit improper social behavior. In fact, about 6% of our population has been evicted over the time that we've been doing this. What we do is work with them, since most of them qualify for disability, is we work with them to help get them some money that they are entitled to because of the law. And so part of it is increasing their income level so that they can pay some. Everyone is required to pay up to 30% of their income. So one of the concepts that's difficult for some people is the thought that people are getting free housing, and that's not true. Everyone has an accountability responsibility in accepting these housing options.
Okay. Let's go next to Shirley in Eau Claire. Hi, Shirley.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Yeah, I wanted to thank those two gentlemen that I've been listening on the radio, that they're doing a remarkable job helping the homeless people. And plus, we have veterans here in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, that are homeless, too. And I've been trying to call different places, try to get some help for them so they can get a halfway decent place. You know, they don't deserve to be homeless.
Right.
And I've begged and begged, but I don't know if they're going to do anything. But I know you guys are doing a remarkable job.
Well, Gordon and Lloyd will help you to tell you where places that might be of some help. Where can Shirley go?
Actually, at the local level, whether it be in Eau Claire or whether in the county level or at the state level, there is someone who would be able to help. If nothing else, you could call the governor's office. And they would direct it, whether you have a Department of Veterans Affairs or whether there's whoever is helping. The previous caller, Ruth, was able to describe that in her community that they had an active homeless helping committee that would allow them to work with this. And my guess is in Eau Claire there's a group that is willing to help. And if not, you just have to search a little bit further and then you'll find someone, because I know that the people of Wisconsin are very caring and certainly want to make sure that their homeless veterans are taken care of.
Thank you, Shirley, very much for your call. And you have a way to be reached, don't you? Is there a website so people can find out how you did what you did in Utah?
We do. We have a website that is www.housing.utah.gov, G-O-V. And on this website, you have to search just a little bit because there are several programs that are there. But there are complete reports of our homeless population for the several years that we've done it, as well as some of our affordable housing sites that help teach how to pull everything together. We have the Pamela Atkinson Homeless Trust Fund, which is a state-funded trust fund that helps support housing, the homeless population. Pamela Atkinson is a tireless advocate for reducing homelessness and taking care of them. In fact, every time that we talk with Pamela Atkinson, she loves to tell us about who she's talked to, and about how she's helped Billy get some warm socks or some gloves or some dog food. It takes caring persons, and we know that the individuals that have been calling in are very caring, and I'm sure that they are doing everything that they possibly could.
Let's go to Rick in Oconomowoc. Hi, Rick.
Hi, how you doing?
All right, Rick, how are you?
What an interesting conversation you're having. I've recently been divorced from my wife of 15 years, and it's devastating.
I'm sure.
Health care reform, this, that, and all the attorneys, I'm wiped out. Mm-hmm. I had nothing. I am now homeless.
Mm.
What's the fix?
Where are you staying? Where do you stay, Rick?
In a little one-room bungalow.
Uh-huh.
A little one-room bungalow. But where's the fix? I hear the problems, but I don't hear the answers.
Well, Rick, maybe we could comment on this just a little bit. It sounds to me like you've gotten the first step taken care of, because if you're protected from the cold at night, you're one step ahead. And as long as you've got that, certainly there are many other issues, and you've got some of them that I'm sure are a struggle for you to deal with. The fact of the matter is that there are people in your community that if you will reach out to them, tell me, Rick, where is it that you live?
He lives in Oconomowoc.
Oconomowoc.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that there are areas that, or organizations, whether it be the shelter system or other nonprofit organizations, that would love to help you with each one of the areas that you mentioned. They don't come easily. Solutions don't come overnight. But, Rick, I'm sure that there are many caring people in your community that would love to help you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Rick, very much for your call. Life is hard to navigate sometimes, isn't it, gentlemen?
It's not simple.
Mm-hmm. And that's and people become homeless because of those very big challenges such as Rick is going through.
Right. Yeah, he's going through a lot. Well, so how close are you to this goal? This is a huge goal to reduce overall homelessness by 2015. You'd probably like to have it gone completely. There will always be some people who are homeless. But what a marvelous goal that is. And it sounds to me as though you might reach it.
Well, we have to make sure that you understand what our goal is, because ending homelessness is different than ending chronic homelessness.
Right.
Certainly, if you wanted an exact date, we'd have to talk again in about 90 days, because at that time, these are discussions that we have all the time, Kathleen, as to when we'll reach the goal. We have been able to identify the individuals, and through the point in time count, we identify them. So we know who is pretty much who is there. We know what their cases are. And as we look at the resources and we pull it together, we're reasonably confident that we'll be able to do it within 2 years. But, you know, you never know. And we know that we will always have more people that we can help and serve. You're right. We would like to be out of this particular goal so that we can go on to the next one. But we're gratified that we have made the progress that we have, and feel that if we just keep going and involve more and more people, more volunteers, greater collaboration, that we will reach the goal eventually.
Well, I think you can tell from our audience that people are just applauding what you're doing. It's really quite remarkable, and may it spread all over the country. Congratulations to both of you. It's such a worthwhile thing to do.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for being with us as well. Our guest joining us from the studios, and thanks to them as well, of Public Radio KCPW in Salt Lake City, Gordon Walker, who's director of Utah's Division of Housing and Community Development. He served as deputy undersecretary for the Department of Housing and Urban Development during the Reagan administration. Thanks to Lloyd Pendleton, who, as a loaned executive back in 2004, wrote and implemented Utah's 10-year plan for ending chronic homelessness. He became director of the Homeless Task Force and has worked on ending chronic homelessness ever since then. He worked for the Ford Motor Company and also with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in the Welfare Department. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this interesting show, and thanks to KP as well for on-air production in our studios here in Milwaukee. Tomorrow, during this time period, with the tragic death of Philip Seymour Hoffman, we'll be talking about this growing problem of addiction. Heroin and opiates seem to have stronger addictive powers, or perhaps they're the popular drug of choice and easily accessible. We'll talk about treatment and how widespread it is, and that's addiction. Tomorrow at 1 o'clock. So we hope you'll stay tuned for that. Stay tuned for hour number two. We'll be talking about the state of Mississippi in the 50s and the 60s.